Welcome to another episode of Medical Narratives Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Gordon, a geriatrician from Toronto. Today, we have a special guest with us, Dr. Herschel Berman, a palliative care specialist, also from Toronto. In this episode, we're delving into the world of palliative care with a unique perspective, including beyond end-of-life scenarios. Dr. Herschel Berman, thank you for joining us. The first question, and this is very important because a lot of people don't understand it, including many of our colleagues. What is the meaning of palliative care, and how has its definition evolved over time?
Well, that's a very good question, and I don't know that there's one specific answer to the question, what is palliative care? A lot of people think that palliative care simply means care right at the end of life, and a lot of people think of that as the last hours or days of life. But there's actually different definitions depending on what sphere you operate in. And I'll give you some examples. So the Ministry of Health in Ontario considers palliative care to be, you know, 1 year. If you're admitted to a palliative care unit or a hospice, it's funded for up to 3 months. But I sort of prefer the Temi Lattner definition of palliative care. The Temi Lattner Center is the center at Mount Sinai Hospital where I work. And we basically consider palliative care a philosophy of care, a focus on patients with a life-limiting illness who are not necessarily dying right now, but will likely die because of the illness that they have. And we focus on living with the illness, not dying from it. We focus on symptom control and quality of life and legacy building. And those are the things that are really important in palliative care. So that's sort of what palliative care is now. Obviously, we do take care of people right at the end of their lives, but we also do so much more.
Yeah, I think actually you covered the issues that I wanted to address following this introduction. I would like to look at the relationship between geriatrics and palliative care, as in my own experience, and that includes working at the palliative care unit at Baycrest, I think we address some different issues. And I wonder if you might start looking at them and then I could follow up with my own experience.
So the first thing I can say is that a lot of people confuse palliative care with geriatrics. And some of the referrals that we get are for patients who need home care but aren't dying of any specific illness. They happen to be homebound because of frailty. They may have dementia. And part of what we do is educate family doctors and family members that there is a difference between palliative care and geriatric care, and that we're not experts in geriatric care. Now, sometimes there is an intersection between palliative care and geriatrics. And for instance, Baycrest has an integrated community care team, which specializes in primary care of the elderly. And there are some patients that we will share the care because palliative care focuses on looking at things with a specific lens, the lens that comfort care is always important and taking care of patients longitudinally, making sure they're comfortable doesn't mean that we shouldn't keep them well at the same time.
I think my particular experience with the intersection of geriatrics and standard palliative care, which occurred at Baycrest, was the transition from when I first started working there and I followed up with my predecessor, at which time we didn't admit people who had as their primary diagnosis even late-stage dementia, because we figured, as you said, they could be looked after elsewhere. But gradually, we began to see applicants who, in fact, could not be looked after elsewhere, that they were, for example, already in long-term care, and in long-term care, because of the restrictions on what you could do in long-term care, could not get proper care, or they were at home and they'd really run the gamut of home care and the families could not manage. And we changed our policy to start admitting people with late-stage dementia to palliative care. And in fact, at the latter part of my tenure at the Baycrest Palliative Care Unit, a very substantial proportion of the patients were late-stage dementia requiring palliative care. And I was so impressed by the kind of transition and needs that I used that experience to write a book, which I have written, called Late Stage Dementia, Providing Compassion, Comfort, Compassion, and Care, in which I focus on especially the latter stages, and where it came into a special, you might say, it wasn't conflict, but difficulty, is that often as part of the treatment of the behavioral issues that often occur in late stage dementia, there was an often reluctance by families for us to utilize neuroleptic drugs to deal with agitation, because they felt that they were, their parent was becoming too sleepy. And yet we knew that for symptom control, and some of it was quite severe, there was a balance. So some of that conversation, which we didn't have with other people who were getting opiates, and everybody accepted opiates for pain, you know, that was acceptable, even if there was some deleterious side effects, using neuroleptics became a problem. And of course, the whole issue of once admitted to palliative care, usually there was an assumption that heroic, in quotes, measures were not going to be introduced. Well, that was always understood and accepted in people, let's say, who had cancer. But somebody who comes in with late stage dementia and stops eating, to tell the family, especially those who happen to be religious, that you cannot put in a permanent feeding tube, for some was anathema, because they felt that you were starving the person. And the same thing with CPR. And that became a problem with our admission criteria, because one of the admission criteria is, and we were able to do that at Baycrest and other units, we would not provide cardiopulmonary resuscitation. And it became quite complicated. But I think gradually, in the realm of dementia, late stage illnesses in the elderly, in the older people, they can benefit from the palliative care philosophy, which focuses, as you mentioned earlier, on comfort, very important comfort, pain, psychological trauma, and as important, and that was something we really focused on at Baycrest, was the psychosocial events. And we had wonderful assistance from music therapists, for example, art therapists. We had a wonderful gardening program that people could focus on things they loved throughout life while they still could. Because just because you have dementia doesn't mean you don't know how to enjoy plants or music. So there was a special focus. And I think gradually we've learned that in the domain of aging, palliative care has a special place to provide the same support, care, comfort, and symptom management.
I think you really bring up a really good point, is that there, you know, we often work in silos. You know, internal medicine works in internal medicine, and surgery works in surgery, and then there's geriatrics and there's palliative care. And this is a really good example. Palliative care itself is an example, but geriatrics as well, I believe, is an example where multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary care is really important. Because as a palliative care physician, I have certain skill sets, and I can talk to families about how feeding tubes don't actually prolong life and have their own risks. And I can talk to them about end-of-life support. We're not as good with the behavioral aspects of dementia as geriatricians might be. And so working together as a team is very important, and it helps the family come to grips with what's happening. It also allows us to provide the kind of care that the patient needs in a setting that is most appropriate for them. So for some people, that might be a palliative care unit. But as you said, there are certain restrictions to a palliative care unit. There are some people who just can't accept a do not resuscitate order. And that's okay, because part of what we provide in palliative care is comfort. And if comfort is knowing that everything will be done until the last moment, for some people, that's really important. And so providing the kind of care that they need in a setting like at home, where they can be or there can be an attempt at resuscitation, I'm under no illusion that the attempt will be successful. But for some people, that attempt is really important. For other people, it's not. And we can help them get through that themselves as well.
Yeah, one of the questions is, are there different medical categories that we use within palliative care? Like, are there subsets that cause special challenges that have to be taken into account when we offer palliative care?
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by medical categories. Do you think you could sort of flesh that out a little bit?
Well, medical categories is, you might say, organ system problems, like end of life. For malignancy, everybody understands it. I think that's, simple. But one of the things that comes up is somebody who has very progressive chronic lung disease, and they've reached the point that without support of respirator, et cetera, they're going to die. Or somebody who has end stage, and this I know was a real issue, heart disease, because cardiologists, the culture of cardiologists is you never give up. There's always another drug class. And for old people like myself who've seen the evolution of drugs, which became life-saving drugs, that for previous conditions, I remember one of my dear colleagues once said, if they ever found, this was in the early days, that beta blockers called cancer, he'd kill himself. Because until then, all we had was nitroglycerin and the limits. So we have sort of special categories, and I wonder if you might mention some of the ones that come that present specific problems in palliative care.
Okay, that's actually a really good question as well. With cancer, we can predict the natural history of the illness, and we can sort of have an idea of what direction things are going. When somebody is referred to me with a certain type of cancer, I can already map out in my brain how things are going to go medically for the patient. So we can map out how things are going to go for the patient. But for other things like lung disease, COPD, for instance, emphysema, or idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, another respiratory disease, or heart failure, as you mentioned, we don't know when somebody is going to have that one event that's going to lead to the end of their life, because they can be grumbling along with a chronic illness for a long time and then have some sort of an illness like an infection or something, which makes them very sick or puts their heart failure out of whack. And then they can get all of these special medications, antibiotics, ventilatory support if they need a BiPAP, sometimes going on a respirator and then coming off it afterwards. And then they may not be as well as they were before, but they may be at a new baseline. And dementia itself is the same. You can have different baselines and an illness or a hospitalization and never really get back to the way you were before and become more frail. And so it's harder to predict what the prognosis will be and how things will go. And there are a lot of people who feel like if there are medications who will help to maintain quality of life, like beta blockers, like certain respiratory medication, if using BiPAP will help keep people alive and provide quality of life, take away shortness of breath, they don't want to stop using those modalities. And some of them aren't available in a palliative care unit. And also, we don't know how long these people will live. So palliative care should get involved early and provide support, symptom control and support while those efforts are being made to prolong life. And it's, again, it's a teamwork between palliative care provider and the specialist in that particular field. And a really good example of that is the Mount Sinai Hospital Heartful Program, where they combine the home palliative care team with a cardiology team at the hospital. And there's always somebody to help the palliative care physician who is in the home doing the examinations, providing direct care, but getting that support to use those fancy medications to keep people as well as possible for as long as possible.
Yeah. I was thinking over my career, many years career, of specific situations, one of which was somebody with end stage, late stage amyotrophic lateral sclerosis who had been on a Cuirass respirator to keep him alive and was coming to the end of time. And the question was, of course, should we intubate him? Well, they happened to be very orthodox. And the discussions we had, and this could be whether it's Jewish, Islamic, Muslim, or Catholic or Christian, what extent do you go to keep somebody alive when in fact what you're going to do is really an intervention that can't be maintained? And I know this comes up for those who are religious in how far those of us in palliative care are willing to provide. The technology nowadays is phenomenal. You can keep people alive for a long time. And the question is, should that be part of the palliative care, you might say, menu, which seems counterintuitive. If we're looking for comfort, nobody could say that being on a permanent respirator can be comfortable. And this sort of gets to the other question is, what aspects of palliative care are important besides clinical treatment, whether it's medications or, as I mentioned before, long-term respiratory support? And this is very important, I think, for those of us who are interested in using the expertise in the palliative care community.
So there's two issues there. And the first one I'd like to address is what we can do versus what we should do. Now I have a couple of patients, one I think currently active, who is on a ventilator with ALS, and he's been on a ventilator for years. And he considers his current quality of life to be acceptable. And so we continue to look after him and maximize his quality of life as long as possible. Every month he has to go to get a change in his tracheostomy. He can speak with the ventilator, and he's doing very well. There are other people who make the decision that they don't want to go on a respirator or a ventilator at all. They don't want to have a tracheostomy. So what we do is we look at individual philosophy of care, individual goals of care. For people who want to follow their religious beliefs, you can have two religious people of the same faith and three opinions on the matter. There is no set decision. So what I recommend is that I ask people how they feel. And if they're not sure, I often recommend that they speak with their religious leader, speak with your imam, speak with your rabbi, speak with your priest and see, you know, what they have to say. And sometimes if they don't have a particular go-to religious leader, we'll try to find somebody who can come in. For instance, Jewish hospice will provide a rabbi to come and speak with the patient. And they're not going to provide, you know, a religious, you know, decision. They're going to help explore the person's feelings and come to a decision that actually works for them. So that was, you know, that's how we help people to decide what they want. And if they don't want to go through ventilatory support, we have ways of easing them to their end of life when it comes that the supports that they have aren't enough. And there's many different things that they can do. In terms of what do we do besides medications, there's actually quite a few things that we do. One of the things is we look at the environment that they're in. So for me, as a home physician, it's what is their home environment like? And occupational therapy, physiotherapy can often be very helpful in this. And we look at mobility. Can we help people get around their house more easily? For people who are very frail or have only a limited amount of energy, we help them focus that energy on things that they enjoy. So if they like watching television, but if they have to walk to the bathroom, they're just too tired afterwards to focus on that, but we'll give them a commode or a hospital bed to help them be cared for without moving as much. Or maybe get them into a wheelchair and wheel them to the kitchen or to the dining room so they can have a meal with family, as opposed to having to try to walk there and having no energy when they're done. So we look at the environment. We also look at psychosocial counseling for people who are struggling with their illness or for family members who are struggling. We try to help them get to that as well. And for some people, legacy is very important. So we talk about legacy work. For parents with small children, we where the parent is sick, we recommend a lot of doing things with your child and not taking pictures of the child, having somebody take a picture of the child with you so that they can be remembered in a more active way. So when the child looks, oh, I remember that I was with my father, I was with my mother. Some technology now exists to allow people to make videos that we can show to their children or grandchildren at certain important points. So let's say a grandparent just loves their two-year-old grandchild and they want to be a part of their bar mitzvah or wedding. You know, a video message that can be archived or a photo or a card. We don't know what the technology will be like in 10 years, but a physical card will still be there. And so they can write cards for those special occasions and still be, we call that legacy building.
Yeah, I remember one very moving situation that was at Baycrest. We had a marvelous music therapist, and she would respond to referrals or people who recognized that music was a special part of somebody's life. And this one gentleman, when asked what he would like to do, and I think he had malignant disease with a prognosis of a couple of months, 3 months, and he said, I want to write an opera. I love music. I want to write an opera. And I want to write an opera in dedication to my two wives, my late wife, who was my wife for 40 years, and my present wife, who's been for 20 years, and they were wonderful women. And the music therapist, who's an unbelievable person, said, well, an opera may be a lot, but we can write an aria. And what they did together was she developed the music after he wrote the lyrics of an aria. And it was quite poetic and beautiful. And we put it together, and he lived long enough to hear it. And it became the basis of an article we wrote, which was published in the Annals of Long-Term Care, that included, which I think was a bit unusual, of course you could do it now with an online journal, to the link of the aria. So that was a very special. We also had another one I remember. He was Italian and was very into gardening. And on the palliative care unit at Baycrest, we have an area where people can tend their plants. Well, he wanted to have a pepper plant that he would grow his peppers, because he did that in his backyard. And he would nurture these peppers. He was in for a number of months until finally, a pepper appeared. And he dealt with that pepper like the birth of a child. So I think sometimes it's not like the traditional what you think of, but I agree with you. You have to pursue whatever works for the person. Whether it's, I know that my wife, who's a very fine pianist, she actually goes to a number of long-term care facilities, including Baycrest, and she plays the piano, and it includes the patients for palliative care, those who can come out into the little social space. And what she does is she always finds out who's at the little concert and tries to bring the right music so everybody's musical tastes are addressed. So we have in her collection of music, she has Yiddish, Jewish, Russian, Italian, Polish, you name it, American, she has it. So there's always somebody. And the thing, I used to go to her concerts, is how much music is appreciated, even at the very, very, very ends of life. It's kind of hardwired. So I think there's a lot we can do to make those days, whatever many you have, as satisfying as possible.
I totally agree. And you remind me of my own grandfather's last days at the Baycrest Palliative Care Unit. He didn't have dementia. He had cancer. He was in the unit, and he used to sing me a lot of Yiddish songs when I was younger. When I started playing the violin, he used to want me to play some of those songs for him on the violin. And so on, I think the day before he died, or maybe the day that he died, And I'm still thankful for the unit for letting me do this. I brought my violin into the unit and I played some of those songs for him. I don't think he was alert at that point, but I was able to play. And that was important for me. And I think that was important for him. Yes. And then another anecdote, we've talked a lot about the palliative care unit, but another thing that I remember very vividly, I actually mentioned this at the wedding of a resident because he was the one who did this. His name is James Downer. He's now an intensive care specialist and palliative care specialist. I think he's the first person in Canada to train in both. But when he was my third year senior resident on internal medicine, we had a patient in the hospital. He was a retired rabbi. And I don't remember exactly what was wrong with him, but he had a lot of problems with shortness of breath. And we were doing our best to look after his symptoms. We had the palliative care team involved, but I was looking after him in internal medicine. And I remember, signing out this patient on a Friday, and I was going off service. And on Monday, I came back and saw him as a palliative care physician because I was looking after my patients as a palliative care physician the next month. And he had told me on the Friday that he would like to write one last sermon, an autobiographical sermon for his family. And he was like telling me this, with three words per breath and things like that. He was very short of breath. On Monday, I came and I saw him and he was very comfortable. His shortness of breath was completely gone. And he told me that the day before, the senior resident, and I don't know if you remember your time in medicine, but the senior resident on call is usually very, very busy on the weekend. The senior resident came in and he took down his sermon word for word, typed it up and gave it to his family. And he called it a transcendental experience. He said he could now die peacefully after this had been done. And he did die a couple of days later. And I remember this. I think I nominated this James for a humanitarian award, which he won that year because of that, because he had made such a difference in this person's life.
Right. Beautiful. Very beautiful. Okay, now we have another issue that comes up, and I'm sure you've experienced that I've experienced, is when you bring up the prospect of palliative care, how quite often people reject it. Either the person themselves, because it sounds like the death sentence, or the family, because for them also, and they are struggling to say, well, what else can we do? And why should we, in a sense, I mean, they frame it sometimes, very graphically. Why should we send our parent to die? But often physicians often think of it also, as you mentioned earlier, that it's an end-of-life decision, and therefore once you decide, they say, there's nothing more, and this is one of the worst things you could say to somebody, there's nothing more to do, I'm sending you to palliative care, which of course gives it the worst, in a sense, reputation. And I remember when we were talking about actually initiating a palliative care unit at Baycrest, it was early on in my career, there was enormous pushback from the board because they said, we can't have a death ward. Think about it, especially with our history. So what are the barriers?
One of the barriers you mentioned is that people consider it to be a death sentence. So I often frame it that we are providing care alongside their other physicians. So if it's an oncologist, they can still get chemotherapy. They can still get all of the care that they want, all of the active treatment, but we're there to provide support for quality of life and to help them live with the illness until they die. And sometimes I even quote, there's an article from 2010 in the New England Journal of Medicine where they actually studied people who had lung cancer, and they had two groups. One received the usual referrals for palliative care, usually downstream near closer to the end of life when there was no more treatment available. And one group got referred to palliative care on diagnosis, if it was metastatic lung cancer, right when they got the diagnosis. And they found that of the whole group, the people who got early referral to palliative care actually lived longer than the people who had the usual referral pattern. And they had less aggressive treatment in the last month of life and better quality of life in that time as well. And one of the reasons we think that that's the case is because if you get to know and you get to trust your palliative care team as you go along that journey, when it comes time for that chemotherapy dose that's going to shorten your life, the palliative care team is there to help people decide when it's time to stop. And for cases where we're not the ones helping people make that decision, we're still there to help them transition from active treatment into active comfort care. And that's a very important aspect to get us involved, not necessarily the home palliative team, but a palliative approach early on. There is a lot of denial in the world. A lot of people don't want to believe that somebody that they love is going to die of an illness. And as a palliative care physician, I've experienced this desire to avoid thinking of it myself in members of my own family. It's a natural human instinct not to want to lose somebody. And so denial is a big barrier that we have. And we, offer to walk with the family and say, listen, you know what? You can still have all the care you want. This is just to make sure your symptoms are controlled. Don't worry about end of life for now. Let's start with quality of life. And that's how we try to get our foot in the door.
Yeah, it sort of feeds in. I mean, the idea, is there anything we could do to decrease the stigma? I mean, the terminology is, people have written articles about this and other things, should we change the name? What's going to be a better name?
So the thing is that right now, the reason that we call it palliative care is because, and we don't call it hospice care like in the United States, is because the term hospice has a French root,
yes,
which has a poor connotation because the hospitals, hôpitaux in sort of ancient France, were not good places to be.
That's right.
Right. So we called it palliative care because that would be more palatable. But now palliative care has a connotation of people dying. So, let's call it supportive care. But if we called it supportive care, then in 10 years, people will look at supportive care in the same way as they look at palliative care now. So the issue is very deep seated. People in our society have what's called death phobia. They're afraid of death, and they're afraid of losing people to death. And I'm not trying to minimize the impact that death has. Obviously, having experienced it in the family as well, it's a great loss. But death is inevitable. And the answer is to educate society that palliative care is there to help people get through what is going to be inevitable, regardless of whether we're involved or not.
Yeah. I once had a comment on something I wrote in my book on late-stage dementia, but describing palliative care and the way we've done it today. And the person said, well, that seems to be the basis of all medical care. The things that are highlighted in palliative care seem to me to be the essence of medical care.
So you just gave away the big secret about palliative care is that everything that we do is good medicine. That's why a lot of palliative care physicians think, and especially internists who provide palliative care, a lot of us think that it should be a mandatory rotation in all specialties. I know that as an internist, when I did an elective in palliative care, it changed the way I was able to provide care in internal medicine. And not everybody has to be an expert on palliative care, but some of the basic principles of palliative care are really essential. Just to even understand how certain medications work, and I'll give you an example because this is really important. There are a lot of people, and doctors included, who think that opioids hasten death.
Yeah.
And I even did a presentation as a resident, and about how to use opioids and was told by a respirologist that I was going to kill their patients by giving them opioids. And we actually have studies that show that when you take an opioid, and I'm not talking about overdosing on an opioid, obviously that can hasten death, but when you take the right dose, and it's not that, it's not rocket science, you know, it's easy to learn how to dose opioids well, they're not that dangerous. When you take the right dose, you don't actually affect the respiration in a negative way. Some people who are short of breath will breathe more quickly, but they usually breathe more shallowly. If you give them an opioid and they feel not short of breath, they'll breathe more deeply. And we've done measurements of the carbon dioxide and oxygen levels, and that those don't change.
No, I remember when those studies came out, it was sort of an eye-opener for many people because they, I mean, we got around it in the world of ethics by saying, you know, double effect. You're doing it for the right reason, so it's acceptable that there's a bad outcome. And then they found you had to change that, so you're doing it for the right reason, and you're improving the outcome, so there's nothing against it. So that's one of the myths and concerns, and I see that in geriatrics with when we talk about treating, let's say, BPSD, psychosis in late-stage dementia, the family says, I don't want you to do that because it'll make them somnolent, tired, not able to communicate, when in fact it may improve, because rather than they're fighting their demons, which is what's happening, they're able to now focus on their family.
That's right. And it's important to debunk the double effect principle, because in medicine, so medical legally, that's a very useful term, the double effect.
Yes.
Because that absolves you of any sort of liability. Yeah. But it doesn't prevent people with a religious commandment to live as long as possible.
Yeah. Yeah.
They would use the double effect as a reason not to use an opioid.
Yeah.
And so I've had to have very serious logical discussions with religious leaders saying, I know you're concerned about opioids because issue of double effect, and this is why that doesn't apply. You know, you're a really great expert on your religion, right? And your goal is to keep somebody alive as long as possible and not to do anything to prevent that. And I'm a physician, and it's my job to operationalize that goal. And you have to trust me that I know how to do that. And when you frame it in a certain way, then you get the religious leader on side, then you can use the opioids the way they're meant to be used. You can achieve the goal of comfort without taking away the goal of having somebody live as long as they can.
Yeah. I've often used, and again, I spent some of my educational time studying Jewish medical ethics because of working at Baycrest. And I'd say, yes, there is a sanctity of life in Judaism, but there's no sanctity of suffering. And this is often forgotten when people invoke, you know, whether it's in Islam or Christianity, sanctity of life. I mean, in the old days, there was a group that actually believed that suffering was good, but I think that those times have passed. So one of the questions that comes up, and you've alluded to it, is there are now different opportunities for palliative care. We've gone from the Cicely Saunders pioneer work in Britain. They called it hospice care, but it was palliative care. And certainly in Canada, it came on later, in the United States, with all kinds of various iterations. But you mentioned home palliative care. I've talked about institutional palliative care. There are now issues in long-term care. Why would somebody in a long-term care facility not be able to stay there for palliative care? Because they often get referred out, even though this was a place that they lived at for, you know, 3 or 4 years. So what's your take on the spectrum of places where you can receive good palliative care?
Yeah, well, I think if you mention Cicely Saunders as the spark that created palliative care in England, I think we can't leave out Balfour Mount, who is the father of palliative care in Canada.
Yeah.
And developed Canada's first palliative care program in Montreal.
Right.
There are a lot of different settings in which you can you can have palliative care now. So we've talked a lot about the palliative care unit. There are also hospices, which are freestandings, which means that they're not physically within a hospital building. Like Baycrest Palliative Care Unit is in the Baycrest Hospital. The Sunnybrook Palliative Care Unit is a wing, part of, you know, wing that's part of the Sunnybrook Hospital. But there are hospices, and I'll give you examples. There's Kensington Hospice, which is downtown. There's a Hill House Hospice. There's Margaret Behan Hospice up in north of Richmond Hill. There are a lot of the freestanding hospices where it sort of integrates the physicians who work usually in a local hospital and also the home care team, and there's nurses and caregivers within those hospices. They can be even a house. Hill House is a house with three rooms, and the doctors from Mackenzie Health, which is a hospital close by, are the physicians there. There is some association with home care. There's going to be a new hospice not far from Baycrest called Neshama Hospice, which is being built. And the thought is that there will be an integration of home services as well as with people working there. So there's hospices, there's palliative care units, and there's home. I often tell people when they're trying to choose, they have to figure out what's best for them. So the equipment and the kind of care that's available at home and in a palliative care unit or a hospice are essentially identical. But how those services are operationalized are a little bit different. So in a palliative care unit, there are nurses there the whole time. And yes, you can stay with your loved one overnight, but you don't have your own bedroom and things like that. Sometimes you don't even have a private room and you pay for parking. But the nurse is always there, and you can get whatever medications you need at the drop of a hat. At home, you've got free parking usually. You've got a place to sleep if you need to, your private shower for caregivers and things like that. But the nurse isn't there all the time. The nurse will come when needed. PSWs come at specific times. They won't be there at different times. You can't just call for somebody to change a diaper. So depending on the kind of care needs that somebody has and the comfort level that people have to look after their loved one, they can make the choice based on that. Third place, or the other place that I think we need to look at is also the acute care hospital. Because some people say, well, but that's not really palliative care, is it? But it is, because for some people, active treatment, whatever that may entail, up until the time of death is important for them. They may not want to be resuscitated, but it might be important to them to stay alive up until the very last moment. And the best way to do that, to achieve that goal, might be in a hospital. Now, going to the emergency department obviously is a nightmare these days. But if they can be admitted to the hospital and, you know, get their transfusions for their bleeding, or have their potassium or taken care of, or get dialysis up until the time that they die, that might be important for them. And so they might have to have their palliative care provided in an acute care setting.
Very good. So we're getting towards the final part of the discussion. I wonder if you would like to just summarize what you would say are the key points that we hope those who are tuning into this can take away.
So I think the key point about palliative care, or any medical care, I think, is that people should receive appropriate care, the care that they want according to their philosophy of care. People should get the care that they want, the way that they want it, in the setting that works best for them. I think that's the overlying principle of palliative care. To do that, I think an integrated team, especially in cases like geriatrics, where we have the best primary care of the elderly combined with symptom control, quality of life. And we should work with patients and work with their families to provide them the kind of care they're looking for in the setting that they want.
Yeah, and I would add to that, just because of my own particular perspective for the care of the elderly, is that we should not exclude older people from the benefits of palliative care for some bizarre notion about aging, because you can even have ageism in palliative care. We have ageism in other parts of medicine. Oh, somebody's too old for this. I've seen this all the time. You're too old for this. You're too old for that. And we've certainly seen phenomenal changes in what can be done in medicine and in acute medicine in the very elderly. I think for palliative care, the inclusion of the older population, whatever concerns they have medically, have to be considered.
Well, so, I don't think that you can ever say you're too old for palliative care.
That's right. That's right. Well, that's it.
Currently, my oldest patient is 108.
Oh, you've beat me, because I'm now working at a Toronto memory clinic, and I'm now seeing people. My father lived to 99, and he had dementia towards the last few years, but he still knew his stock portfolio. That was the amazing thing. Right to the end, I would always ask him, so what's Toyota doing? He said, well, I looked it up this morning. Now, maybe he was not giving me the right number, but he was pretty close. So I really think that we have to be very inclusive and make sure everybody, the whole spectrum, is covered. Anyway, I want to thank you, Herschel, for an outstanding presentation on your part and bringing together all the important points of palliative care. And I hope that those who tune in on a regular basis to our podcasts will have gleaned something from the discussion. So on behalf of everyone, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.